Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. I'm hesitant to bring this up because it's so weather dependent, but the comet Pan-STARRS is closest to the sun today, a mere 28 million miles. And according to the website space.com, comet Pan-STARRS should be bright enough to see without the aid of telescopes or binoculars, weather permitting. But the comet is also appearing low on the western horizon at sunset, so some planning is needed to spot this comet with the naked eye tonight. If you look too early, the sky will be too bright, according to a spokesperson at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. If you look too late, the comet will be too low and obstructed by the horizon. So you've got a relatively small window with the comet Pan-STARRS tonight, even if the weather doesn't cooperate here, and it looks like it probably won't. I'm sure there'll be all kinds of online viewing opportunities. Just Google comet Pan-STARRS, P-A-N, two words, P-A-N-S-T-A-R-R-S, comet Pan-STARRS. On Monday, former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick was convicted on 24 of 30 charges, including racketeering and extortion. Contractor Bobby Ferguson's and Bernard Kilpatrick's verdicts were also announced. MLive's Gus Burns has been covering the trial and joins us by phone from Detroit. Hi, Gus.
Hey, good morning.
Can you talk to us about the responses these verdicts have triggered among Detroiters? What kinds of things are you hearing people say most often?
They're saying that this may help restore some credibility to government. It may put some fear into corrupt politicians' minds and help maybe down the road to avoid some more of this happening. I think a lot of people are displeased that it's behind the city. It's been hovering above the city ever since Kilpatrick came into office. There's been scandals surrounding him, so this kind of closes the chapter on that.
Did you get the impression that Detroiters anticipated so many guilty verdicts on Kwame's part?
I didn't. It was really hard to read. I mean, there were so many charges, and so many of them weren't as serious. I mean, there was a lot of smaller charges like mail fraud and things. It was really difficult, I thought, to tell which way the jury would go, considering that, you know, one lone juror dissenting could have caused an acquittal.
Yeah.
So I think it was surprising that, you know, at least a lot of the reporters that were following it, that there were as many guilty verdicts as there were.
The story dragged on a long time, as you said, for a number of years. Did some number of people tune it out, or did you get the impression that most Detroiters continued to follow it pretty closely?
I'd say it was tuned out quite a bit. I mean, I remember when the federal case first started, I walked around and talked to people around the courthouse, and a lot of them didn't really seem to know what was going on, to know that he was back in court again. They knew he'd been to jail twice before related to the state charges, but weren't real familiar with what he was charged with in federal court and things like that. So, I mean, I think as the case went on, people couldn't help but catch up with it if they watched the news at all.
Yeah.
So I don't think people were following it that closely until towards the end.
I'm especially curious if these verdicts are likely to have any impact on this emergency manager discussion. What's your take on that?
You mean in the sense of what exactly? I mean,
are they related at all? Is Detroit, since I guess the first narrative that comes to my mind is, since Kwame has been found guilty of so much wrongdoing, does that make, in some Detroiters' minds, does that make the city better suited for an emergency manager than if he had gotten off?
I think so. I mean, I think a lot of people perceive that this isn't the only corruption that exists in government, that just the charges that came forward from the federal government in this case. So I think the idea that an outsider could step in and maybe help clean up more does make the city better suited for an emergency manager. But I also think that being the administration has brought in a much cleaner seeming government than existed before.
You've got Detroit's at such an interesting crossroads right now. You've got Kwame off to jail. You've got a new emergency manager likely quite soon. And you've got a mayoral and city council election on the horizon. This adds up to quite a house cleaning, really, in a way, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I mean, I was wondering if the emergency manager would affect people running for mayor. I haven't heard anyone dropping out because of that yet. But yeah, I mean, I heard on the news the other day there was 160 applications for city council picked up so far. So.
Wow. Wow. What kind of mayoral race do you anticipate?
I haven't really been following it all that closely other than who's running. I think it's going to be pretty heated. I mean, I think it always is in Detroit. A lot of people that are from the city are passionate about it, and they want to get into government. And a lot of them are already part of government, so It can get pretty political.
Mike Duggan could become Detroit's first white mayor in decades. That would be quite a change, too. Are you out of a job now? What are you going to cover now that the Kwame chapter is over?
Well, I mean, that was just a portion of what I was following. I mean, I didn't follow it every day. I was there probably a little less than half the actual days of testimony.
Very good. Hey, Gus, we appreciate your time.
Oh, no problem. Thank you. Bye.
By the way, we were talking with MLive's Gus Burns from Detroit, who's been covering the Kwame Kilpatrick verdicts. The latest episode in the NioWave pole barn dispute took place just last night. The Lansing City Council held a public hearing regarding the company's recent application for a tax break on its property on North Walnut Street. The company's relationship with its neighbors has been frosty ever since discussions broke down some months ago over improvements the neighborhood wants made to a massive pole barn that went up last summer. Lansing City Councilman Brian Jeffries is chairman of the council's Planning and Development Committee. We welcome Brian Jeffries back to Current State. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me back.
Sure. And Walnut neighborhood activist Dale Schrader joins Current State to update the situation as well. Dale, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And again, we asked NioWave representatives to join the conversation. Again, they declined. Brian Jeffries, this was a public hearing about a tax break for NioWave. What is the company asking for exactly?
Well, they've done an expansion on their property, and which is kind of the root cause of all of this. But within the expansion, they want to place $5 million worth of new equipment. And based on that expenditure, they're asking the city for a personal property exemption, which would run for a period of 6 years and probably net a savings to them of around $550,000.
Okay. And how does this add to any existing tax breaks?
Well, when they first came to the site back in, I believe it was 2006, they purchased an old school from the Lansing School District and renovated that. There were several tax abatements that supported the renovation of the building, as well as bringing in equipment into that building to operate it as a laboratory. They got both an OPRA certificate as well as a personal property exemption. I think that was close in total to around $1 million in abatements.
So as far as the Walnut neighborhood is concerned, this dispute over the pole barn was at an impasse. In fact, the last we heard, communications had ceased between the neighborhood reps and the company. Where does that put this request? How did this play out last night, request for the other tax break?
Well, a surprise happened. You're absolutely right in your characterization. We went through a process where we had asked the neighborhood to actually sit down with NioWave and kind of work out the differences. And again, it surrounds the whole pole barn that was built there. And basically, there was an impasse that was reached, I believe, back in December, where the neighborhood said, look, we want a facade replacement. NioWave was at a position where they said, we'll throw $100,000 in terms of landscaping and call it good.
Okay.
And so, you know, we had asked them to do that. That was their decision. Basically, the impasse hit, and we started to move forward on the personal property exemption request based on that information. Last night, we received a joint memo from Terry Krim, who's the CEO for NioWave, and Mary Lynn Keener, who's part of the neighborhood, who've basically resumed discussions yesterday and are talking about not only the $100,000 for the landscape, but NioWave's willingness to mutually explore some sort of facade alternatives. You know, the timing on this is the 11th hour. It's always good that negotiations and talks continue. I'm just not sure what this is going to do in terms of the impact on their request.
How is it the 11th hour, though? Is the council obligated to vote on the new tax break package soon?
Well, yeah, we have this scheduled for a vote in 2 weeks.
Okay.
The request itself is based on a timetable that began January 1 of this year and runs for a 3-year period of time. So as long as that gets put out, it's less of an abatement for NioWave. So I think everybody wants to wrap that piece up as soon as possible, just unclear as to where these discussions are going.
Well, judging by the atmosphere after last night's public hearing, can an accommodation be reached in a couple of weeks?
I think there was a lot of surprise. I don't think a lot of people knew that this discussion piece was ongoing, particularly within the neighborhood. I think what I saw last night was some people going different ways now. I think the parties were pretty clear where they were in terms of the neighborhood was here, NioWave was here. Now we have at least one member of the neighborhood starting up the discussions, and again, I applaud the effort. It's just the timing in question.
How many speakers had anything to say, and generally, what did they have to say?
We had speakers that represented the entire city and various neighborhood organizations around the city. I would say that there was probably around 20, and pretty much all of them would like to see something worked out, but if it couldn't, that they were opposed to the abatement. And they also wanted to make sure that as we move forward, something like this doesn't happen in their neighborhood, and to make sure that we deal with that, which we are, as a separate piece to this.
This does have an impact for the rest of the city, correct?
It absolutely does.
Okay. Dale Schrader, you're the Da Vinci of the NioWave mini pole barn here.
Yes.
For people who haven't seen it, describe it, please.
Well, it's a 8x10 enclosed white trailer that we modified to put a peak roof on it with a corrugated white roof and painted the blue stripe around the bottom. It eerily looks a lot like the pole barn, a little mini pole barn, and that's what we call it. The idea behind that was when we did reach an impasse, NioWave said landscaping is fine. And we said, no, you have to do something with that building. You have to fix the building. And the idea was to give them a taste, just a slight taste of what it would be like to see this parked in front of their homes, in their neighborhoods. And therefore, it was built.
Now, given the cautious optimism, I guess, that came out of last night's meeting, are you inclined to give the mini pole barn a break for a while, or are you still going to use it?
I think we're going to give it a break for now. Cautiously optimistic. We've had 9 months of silence and arguments with NioWave, and then yesterday we had this little breakthrough. And if I was someone that wanted $500,000, I would make a couple phone calls and reach out and try to do something. We'll give it a break, and we'll see what happens. There's going to be some discussions in the next few days. Something would have to happen very quickly, though. And I'm not sure we can do it that quickly. The vote's in 2 weeks.
Can we say who is talking to whom here exactly?
Mary Lane Keener is a resident neighbor. She is speaking with NioWave. I'm going to speak with NioWave tomorrow.
And when you say NioWave, is this Terry Grimm?
Mr. Jerry Hollister. He's the CEO of NioWave. Yeah. I'll be speaking with him. He approached me after the meeting, and that's a first. That's actually a first.
Okay.
That someone has reached out, but the vote is in 2 weeks. So I think between the pole barn and the tax abatement and things like that, we've got their attention now.
Was there direct contact last night then between Walnut neighborhood representatives and Niowave people that hasn't taken place in a while? I gather there was.
I think there was, at least between Mary Elaine and Niowave, and then during and after the meeting, there were a number of discussions that were ongoing. But Dale's absolutely right. I mean, we have a very short period of time to deal with this, and I think, you know, as we move forward, if there is any, whatever the agreement is going to be, I mean, it's really going to have to be buttoned down tight in terms of offering the incentive, and then what is Niowave going to do for that incentive in terms of whether it's the landscaping, facade improvements, or whatever. Typically, what we'd like to see is kind of those issues going together, but you're not going to see any facade improvement in 2 weeks. And so that's something I think council's going to have to do in terms of conditioning the incentive and maybe putting a clawback provision in the incentive that, you know, if you don't do this, then we can take the incentive back and you have to refund any of the abatement that you have received. So those are things that we can look at in terms of trying to tie it up and to assure things are going to get done.
We learned just before we went to air here that from Mary Elaine Keener, as a matter of fact, that she is expressing cautious optimism as a result of contact with Niowave's Terry Grimm, and she's especially encouraged about some kind of mural that apparently is being discussed. Do either of you know anything about that?
There was some statement last night during the meeting that months ago, a mural was offered to be placed on the side of the building. I think that was a first that a lot of people heard about that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, my understanding of what I've heard from both the neighborhood as well as the company.
That was the first we'd ever heard of any proposal for a mural or anything to do with the facade. And they actually brought it up at the meeting and said they had proposed a mural, which is, it's false, basically. It is not. That was not true.
Okay.
We had never heard about a mural. Now they're saying mural, and again, we'll look at it and see what it is. And a mural, the building's 14,000 square feet. We'll have to look and see what it is and how it looks.
Mural.
And yeah.
So now, I'm under the impression Niowave offered $100,000 worth of landscaping improvements in December. Do I have the timeline on that?
Yeah.
Is there any better consensus on what the cost would be to the company for adequate revisions to the landscape? I mean, is there a number in circulation there?
To the landscape, I don't know. But I did do some research on the facade, and to do it properly with, say, faux bricks or something, and do something about the roof, it looked like it was in the neighborhood of $250,000. Is what I came up with, just from some rough estimates with contractors.
And with the landscaping, Niowave had hired a professional landscaper to come in and put a plan together. It was my understanding that the plan ran from a low of $150,000 to a high of around $250,000 or $300,000. And we're still only talking about $100,000 here. So in terms of what the $100,000 buys and what that means, you know, we certainly haven't seen the plan, and that's something that we're going to ask for as the issue moves forward.
We're talking with Brian Jeffries of the Lansing City Council and Dale Schrader, who's a Walnut neighborhood activist, about the latest Niowave's pole barn situation. Brian, the last time you joined us here on Current State, you suggested city administrators may have dropped the ball in the process of approving the pole barn. Do we know anything more about that?
No, we're still looking into that, and, you know, how that may end up, I mean, we can't take, you know, put the genie back in the bottle in the sense of we're going to tear the pole barn down or anything like that. It is what it is at this point. What we have to do is make sure that it doesn't happen again, and we've reviewed the process upon which this came about, and we've put together an ordinance that we're going through the approval process right now, that in the future any of these projects would have to come back to City Council for reapproval. So we're not going to just have an administrative review. There will be a council review that has a full public hearing process. It involves the neighborhood, and it actually will involve action to have to be taken by council to approve any amendment to any special land use that we permit, so we don't run into this again. You know, as I think I said in your last show about this, the city is the backstop on it. We're the ones that are responsible to make sure that there's responsible and reasonable development that goes on in these neighborhoods, and this simply didn't fit, doesn't fit, and fell through the cracks.
This is very interesting, though, in light of the challenges that East Lansing went through last year, and people lost their jobs, and there was some serious rearrangement of the city administration in East Lansing. So,
I hear you.
Does it rise to that level or not?
Well, maybe.
If you live there, it does.
Yeah, that's an issue for the city administration. Council has no control over any of those employees. I think what we're doing is what we can in terms of making sure that we have a process in place that backstops the backstop, in the sense that it will come back to council and will not simply be an administrative review and decision.
Okay. Dale Schrader, Brian Jeffries, we want to stay in touch. Many thanks for joining us today on the NioWave Pole Barn.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Current State on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. More than half of all college graduates are women, yet the shortage of women in some professions is still notably less. That fact is what gave birth to STEMinists, Michigan Women in Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. That's a new exhibit opening this week at the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame in Lansing. STEMinists profiles women who have become successful in various STEM fields. Emily Fiegel joins me to talk about the exhibit. Emily is the curator of STEMinists and the assistant director of the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame in Lansing. Good morning.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by one of those women profiled in the exhibit, Dr. Elizabeth Simmons, a physicist at Michigan State University and the dean of Lyman Briggs College. Welcome to Current State.
Glad to be here.
So, Emily, how challenging was it to find women to profile?
You know, we went back and forth on how we wanted to do this exhibit, whether we wanted to take a more historical perspective and look at sort of pioneers in the fields, or if we wanted to look at more contemporary women. And we chose the contemporary path because ultimately our goal is to inspire girls to approach these professions and pursue them. So we thought that they might identify more with some contemporary figures. It got challenging to find the women. We had to network a lot with different women's organizations to find them. But, they are out there and they are at the tops of their fields, and it was a pleasure to talk with them.
How compelling is the data regarding women in the STEM fields? Do we know? Do we have numbers?
It's a popular area for research right now, so we do have numbers. In areas such as biological sciences or social sciences, women are definitely on the rise in those fields, but in things that we consider hard sciences, they're not climbing as quickly. Areas like computer science, the numbers have actually increased post-Title IX in the late 70s, and they're decreasing and holding steady at this point. So in some areas, it is growing, but not across the board.
Elizabeth Simmons, how does it feel to be profiled at the Hall of Fame in this way?
Well, it's a real honor, and it's very exciting. I was thrilled when Emily contacted me.
Give us your own view as to why the STEM fields are underrepresented, just from your own experience.
So I think there are a couple of factors. One is because there are few women, and in the physical sciences, you're less likely to have a teacher who's a woman, less likely to see role models, and that makes it harder to imagine yourself as a future physicist or mathematician.
Okay.
But I think the other thing is that in the physical sciences, we haven't done as good a job of explaining what you do with that career and how it can benefit humankind and benefit the world. When someone's studying biology, they know, I could become a doctor, I could try to cure cancer. They can imagine themselves helping humanity. And a lot of young women want to have a kind of career where they know that they will help people. And in the physical sciences, we haven't made clear how does having a physics or engineering degree really help you help people.
And do we pay a societal price for this?
Absolutely, because we lose lots of talented people,
and
there are jobs going wanting because they can't find the people who are needed. And if more women were studying, that would be more people studying and getting those degrees and then taking those jobs.
From your own experience, Elizabeth, what kind of roadblocks did you encounter, specifically because you're a woman?
So when I was in high school and through college, I certainly encountered people who simply didn't believe that a girl or a woman could study these fields successfully. And I had people tell me that. I had people not take me seriously, try to flirt with me instead of teaching me, all these sorts of things all the way along the line, from teaching fellows to some teachers. And that was really sad because I just wanted to learn the material. But I also encountered some wonderful people who were very supportive, both men and women, and that really helped me keep going.
How do the young women that you meet in your role at Lyman Briggs differ from you and your peers from decades ago? I mean, do they face similar challenges, or do they face a host of new, different ones?
I think that the overt discrimination and the overt sexism is a lot less nowadays. So they come in with more confidence that they can go in and be taken seriously and they can succeed. And that's just a huge boost. There's still not as many fellow classmates who are women when they're looking around to do problem sets with people. But at least there are a lot more women in the class, so they know they're not the only one in the classroom. So I think that helps them have a more conducive environment. And there are more women professors. They won't look and see, oh, none of the professors in this department are women. They'll say, okay, there are a few, and I can go talk to them. And that really helps.
I'm so intrigued in your role as just that generational difference, how you must encounter much younger women. And you say, you know, that was me 30 years ago, or look at how different their challenges are from the challenges that I face. That must be such an interesting window on this whole process.
It absolutely is. I knew women a few years older than me in college who had been the only woman in the class, so no women in their study group. We always formed study groups, and I was in one that was half men, half women. This was a revolution. A few years later, there was an all-woman, four-person study group. That was mind-boggling that could even exist for me. And now I think for many, there's much less of an issue with that. They know if they want to study with other women, they can do that. Those other women are there. And so just knowing that there are other people, I think, really helps.
STEMinists is the new exhibit just about to open at the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame on Malcolm X in Lansing. It's Michigan Women in Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math, and we're talking to Emily Fiegel of the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame and Dr. Elizabeth Simmons, who is one of the women profiled in the exhibit. She is a physicist at Michigan State University. Emily, tell us more about some of the other women you profile.
We drew women from all areas of STEM. So we have engineers. We have, for example, the chief engineer from the Mackinac Bridge is a woman. So we interviewed her as a civil engineer. We interviewed Lisa Drake, who's the first female chief engineer at Ford Motor Company. We have mathematicians, several here from MSU. A former actuary who is now president and CEO of the Accident Fund in Lansing. Just so many women. We also interviewed some women that are from Michigan originally, such as Dr. Paula Hammond, who's now a chemical engineer at MIT in Massachusetts and doing amazing things with nanotechnology. So we tried to focus on a lot of the hot areas in their fields too,
mm-hmm.
You know, exciting things that women and girls can feel inspired to work on.
So much of this is just enabling younger people to see examples, just the example that other people set. That is still a very powerful thing, correct?
Yes, that's exactly it. And we focus on that every day at the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. One of the things we love to say is, if you can see it, you can be it.
Yeah.
One of the major issues with girls in these areas is that nobody encourages them or even talks to them about what this is. If you ask any girl, you know, what is an engineer, they're probably not going to have a clue what an engineer actually does. And so we want to tell them what they do and show how creative and, you know, diverse these fields are. And there's just such potential for anything that girl or woman is interested in. They can find a way to do that through these STEM fields.
These are demanding fields. I mean, many young men face serious challenges in these fields as well. Are they just profoundly different kinds of challenges? Or what, Elizabeth?
I think part of it is a matter of how we're conditioned to respond to stress. I mean, young men are perhaps taught to respond to stress by putting on a bit of bravado and saying, well, the problem isn't with me, it's maybe the test was a bit unfair. And young women, you see, will instead say, oh, I must not be smart enough if I didn't do well on the test. Same test, maybe they got the same score, but they'll react differently. But I think that the more that both the young men and young women just get more mentoring and more chances to try out actual science instead of only doing homework and problem sets and so on, the more they can really honestly evaluate how well they're doing and mm-hmm. learn how to persist.
Emily, what else is at the Hall of Fame?
We have a lot of great things going on. As well as opening the new exhibit on Thursday, we are unveiling the plaques for the 2012 Michigan Women Hall of Fame inductees. And we have a small exhibit called Not Just a Man's War on Michigan Women During the Civil War. And we have an art exhibit as well by Valeria Davis called My Journey. It's amazing contemporary work. So we have a lot of different things going on. It is Women's History Month, and so we are busy, busy, busy at the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame, and we're celebrating that this Thursday.
STEMinists, Michigan Women in Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math, opens this week at the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame in Lansing. Again, it is a Women's History Month reception and a Hall of Fame induction, 5 to 7 on Thursday. The reception is free and open to the public, and the exhibit continues through next February there on Malcolm X near downtown Lansing. Emily Fiegel and Elizabeth Simmons, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Time banks have been cropping up across the country as an alternative method of community building. There's one just starting here in Lansing. Very loosely, participants in a time bank trade work hours in a common effort toward community improvement. But there's way more to it than that, and here to give us a much better explanation of what time banks do is Edge Brussel, coordinator of the new time bank here in Lansing. Welcome.
Hello.
And also joining us by phone from Madison, Wisconsin, Stephanie Rierich. She's the co-director of the thriving Dane County Time Bank there. Welcome, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Let's start out with just a good working rudimentary definition of what a time bank is. Stephanie, you want to take that?
Sure. Well, some of the listeners will have heard of a babysitting co-op, and if you have, it's like a babysitting co-op, but for everything. So it's a place where we bank our time. It's a mutual credit network, so we get together and decide to extend credit to each other. And what that means is we list what people have to offer each other, and it can be very simple things from walking a dog or calling someone to check in on them to something like teaching a language or fixing a computer. And every hour I spend helping another member in the time bank, I get an hour in my account, and I can turn around and use that to help another member. I mean, to get help from another member, so I can teach you a piano lesson 1 month, and the next month I can get my computer fixed. And it's very flexible. I can spend hours before I earn them or vice versa. And really the goal is to connect people and match unmet needs with unused resources. So besides really connecting needs, connecting people with what they need, it really connects people with each other who they wouldn't have met otherwise. So it's a great way to build community and then also pool resources, which we'll talk about more later.
How do you get the members, though? How do you start this whole thing?
Well, everybody has something they need, and one thing that a lot of people in this country really need desperately is more of a sense of community. So I've found that it's very... that it's a pretty easy sell when you start talking with people about it, and you just really need to start by getting a group of people together who are interested in making these kinds of exchanges. And for us, it's spread a lot via word of mouth, and the trick is getting a diverse enough group of people who have really different needs and assets from each other so you can really get the exchanges flowing. And for us, it really made a big difference to really bring people together around common community goals and view our time bank as a way that we pool our resources to be able to work together to meet goals like restorative justice or health and wellness access or energy efficiency, those kinds of things.
Edge, what's it like getting Lansing's time bank started?
You know, people that I've spoken to are very receptive and excited about this getting started. I think everyone that I've spoken to has wanted to become involved, is excited that this is happening. I haven't really had anyone think it's a bad idea for the community. I think it is a pretty easy sell. Neighbors need to get to know their neighbors. We need to transition away from this economy of strangers to an economy of trust.
Hmm. And everybody needs something, and everybody's got something to give. So, I mean, that makes the exchange really, theoretically at least, it makes it really quite feasible. Stephanie, it sounds like a great idea, but also one that would be difficult to get momentum going. What does it take? You're up and running. You're successful. What does it really take to become successful?
It really just takes energy from the people involved. A time bank is exactly, well, it's greater than the sum of its parts, but the parts need to be active and participating. And that's why I mentioned bringing people together around common goals is extremely helpful. So one of the goals for us was really changing the dynamic of how many kids were sending to prison or getting into the prison system. So a goal for us was to start a restorative justice youth court program, and it resonates with a lot of people here. A lot of people really want to see something change there, so it's an easier thing to get people involved in. And people are used to volunteering or working in situations where they have structure and they go in and know what they're supposed to do. And it's really helped our time bank to actually put some structure around some of the work that people do in the time bank, partly because that's what people are used to. And also it's more exciting when you're motivated by something that's where you're really doing something in your community that you want to see happen.
So it's practical and it's idealistic at the same time.
Yeah,
really,
absolutely.
In a way. It can be both. Edge, do you have a particular focus like that for Lansing's time bank?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is we want the people that join to bring their focus. But right now, the two focuses that we have are food. Right now, Lansing's economy is tied to the national economy. It's tied to the rise and fall. And right now, we want to take that and shift it to being sustainable and being able to create our own food, get more people out growing food, teaching people how to prepare that food and store it for the winter. Our other focus is on collaborating to educate each other, to teach each other and to reskill, to help share what we know with the people around us.
What do you need most right now? Do you just need to get the word out about this thing? How are you approaching growing the Lansing Time Bank?
Yeah. We need people involved on all levels. You know, first of all, I would say if this is an idea that excites you, we would love to come to your neighborhood and go door to door with you and talk to your neighbors and invite them to a community potluck of your neighbors to talk to the individuals that are closest to you about what the needs of your neighborhood are. We need people to just join and be excited about being on the system. We need people on all levels to help us.
Okay. Stephanie, any advice you feel you can offer Edge as she launches Lansing's Time Bank?
I would say keep doing what you're doing, and the things that you're focusing on now are great, and just the ideas that you have about how to connect with people. So that's the main thing. It spreads best through word of mouth and with people understanding that it's really what you make of it. So you can build something really beautiful and exciting when you get the people involved.
A question for both of you. Stephanie, how do you respond to people who say, you know, I love all your goals, but I really don't feel like I've got anything to offer. I've got really anything to give. How do you respond to those comments?
If you're speaking to me right now, you have something to offer. You could call people and check in on them or visit with people. And a lot of the things that are really in demand are very simple things like companionship and recreation and transportation. So everyone has something to offer. I would just have a conversation with the person and find out what they like to do. One thing that is good about the time bank is it gives you a chance to do more of what you like and less of what you don't like.
Edge, any response to that? Have you encountered that response yet? I love the idea of making the community a better place. I'm all about food and education, but I really got nothing to share.
Yeah, I would say the community needs you. I spoke to an elderly woman, and she came up to me and said that same thing. She took my hand and said, you know, this is great, but I don't have anything to offer. Yeah. And you know, I spent 5 minutes talking to her about, you know, the things that she loved to do when she was younger. And she said, you know, I used to keep a garden, but I obviously can't do that anymore. And, you know, we suggested to her, well, what if we got a group of kids to come over and you could teach them how to garden? And her face lit up. Everyone has something to offer, just as Stephanie said.
Stephanie, how important is funding? Can you get the lion's share of your work done with a modest amount of funding, or could you really use cash here?
We could all really use cash, and we tend to operate on shoestrings. And we are running 4 youth court locations. We have a Time Bank store. We're a partner in Energy Co-op, really building an energy efficiency program. And we have a wellness project. And we do all that with what's, for a lot of time, makes a large budget, about $200,000. But when you think about all the activity that's happening, it's a pretty small budget. So we are able to stretch our money pretty far. But at the same time, people who are working on it full time still need to pay mortgages and pay for the lion's share of their energy and food with in the cash economy. So we do need to pay people with money. And so we're always looking for funding. And so if you're listening to this and you want to donate to the Lansing Time Bank, I encourage you to, because they'll need funding to get started.
But you can get a lot done with partnerships, though, correct?
Yes, tons. Yeah.
Edge, where are you looking at for partnerships?
Yeah. So first, I just wanted to say, in talking to the other time banks, we've learned that, you know, one of the main reasons why time banks fail is that they start out with a beginner grant, and then that grant doesn't get renewed, or they have one coordinator who is paid, and then that pay goes away, and the time bank sort of collapses. Mm. So we're trying to figure out how to do this with as many community partners, caring about nesting time banking within their model. We're specifically reaching out to people in the food movement, to the gardening network, but really any nonprofit. A partnership between the Time Bank and any nonprofit organization will help and support both. Because if a nonprofit is able to start giving time dollars as an incentive to their volunteers, they will help ward off volunteer burnout, and they'll have people excited about being part of this local currency. So,
Stephanie, how exactly did you get the juvenile justice system and the school district on board? What were those conversations like? How big a job was that?
It was pretty significant, and as you referred to it, partners and champions, we approached people right off the bat who were involved in that aspect of the system who we thought had common values. So we found our allies in that system and started communicating with them right away. And it was at least a year-long process before we actually started the youth court, and then we started it, and then we had to be up and running on a really small pilot, sort of under the radar scale, and then people noticed the results we were having and picked it up more. So for us, a lot of it's just pulling together who you can and starting something on a small scale, because people have a hard time grasping the possibilities of something brand new to them until they see a little bit of the evidence.
Edge Brussel, we've got some number of listeners who are interested enough in this to place a phone call or visit a website. Where do people go?
Absolutely. So first off, you could like us on Facebook, GreaterLansing.com, Greater Lansing Time Bank at Facebook. You can email us at GreaterLansingTimeBank@gmail.com. You can call us at 517-862-0422. Again, that's 517-862-0422. And GreaterLansingTimeBank@gmail.com. We will also be at the Avenue Cafe next Tuesday the 19th. The Avenue Cafe on Michigan Avenue will have a big sign that says Greater Lansing Time Bank. Please come talk to us.
Edge Brussel is the organizer of the new Lansing Time Bank. Stephanie Rearick joined us by phone from Madison, Wisconsin, the Dane County Time Bank. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Tonight at Holt High School, it's round one of the first annual Holt and Mason Scholarship Challenge. This is an amateur talent competition. Music, dance, comedy, visual art, poetry, you name it. It's open to all kinds of creativity, and it's not just student talent either. This is open to all ages. And here to publicly atone for this idea, Delhi Township Supervisor C.J. Davis. Welcome, C.J.
Thank you, Mark.
And Mason Mayor Leon Clark. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. My tongue was firmly in cheek here
on that previous
comment. Tonight's lineup of performers is totally full at Holt High School, but there are at least two more rounds to this, and this is all about raising scholarship money for students in the Holt and Mason schools. CJ, tell us more.
Yes, this started as an idea when I was running for supervisor in the last election, because I'm a part-time musician who used to have a ponytail and cut it to run, and I learned about Leon, the mayor of Mason, who is a professional musician, still has his ponytail, much to my
chagrin. He's a brave man.
He is, and so I thought it would be fun to have a battle of the bands, and then Leon and I got together, and he suggested that we turn it into a talent show. So the idea sprang from that, and people have jumped on board to put on an event very quickly at the township. So we have lots of things happening. And the next round is April 9th. So anybody that would like to sign up, young or old, that lives in either Mason or Holt school districts can sign up at Mason website or the Holt website for the next show.
So is it a good thing that more musicians are becoming local government officials?
Yet to be
is that really the way forward here, guys? That's what I want to know.
Well, I got to say that CJ is being way more generous when he says I'm a professional musician. I've been playing in a band for a long time. I don't know if that qualifies you as being
and you
a professional.
Get paid for it. And you get paid for it, right? we also want to make clear that the lineup is full tonight.
Yes.
But I mean, the attendance is...
It's, anybody can come. We've got 800 seats. There is no admittance to come in. We do ask if you're in the ability to donate to the scholarship fund, because that's, after all, this is also a fundraiser that pits both communities against each other. We're going to get businesses involved to see which community can outraise each other for our scholarship funds. And then we have some corporations that are going to do some matching funds on top of that. So ultimately is to help send our high school graduates to a couple years of college is the goal. So the whole thing is to benefit the scholarship.
Do you have are these existing scholarships that are or are you launching something new?
No, Mason has an established scholarship program.
Okay.
The Promise Scholarship.
The Mason Promise.
Yes.
Okay.
But Delhi is just now getting theirs up.
Okay. Do you have a target sum that you would like to raise with these things? Are you setting a particular goal?
This one is getting it going, because we thought it was very important to start something now to plant the seed, so that then we have the rest of the summer to get in and start pulling everybody together. So everybody's jumping in on this one and doing a tremendous job of getting it started. But we realize the first time you do anything, Mark, I think you might know this well, you might have a few snafus. There might be some things that go on so that we can, the first one has been a lot of fun, and it's been amazing to me to watch Leon and so many people just saying, what do you need? And that's what communities are about.
That's neat.
Right?
I hate to discourage you, but sometimes things go wrong the second, third, and fourth times, even when the first time goes well. So that's my take on this whole thing. What kind of talent is on the lineup tonight? You got a lot of music.
We've got about four bands, age groups from a 12-year-old playing clarinet up to people doing classical music on the piano. We have some bands that are in my age group, which is my age group and not your age group.
Classic rock.
So there's all sorts of things. It's really, quite touching. We have a couple artists that put in some drawings that we're going to display out front. So really, it's young and old and is going to be a hoot.
This is Holt High School. I'm just hoping you drew the line at plate spinners.
Yes, there's okay, none of those.
Although it has been years since I've seen a really good plate spinner, so I don't know. You are both musicians. Does this culminate in some kind of showdown between the two of you?
I think that the trash talking has already started. You know, I've been doing this for a long time and been out in public a lot, and CJ's never been out of the basement, so I think we have a clear-cut advantage, but we'll see.
How long has the Mason Promise been around?
Yeah. I knew you were going to ask me that, and that's actually a separate entity than what I'm involved in. I think they've been around at least 5 or 6 years that I know of, probably longer than that.
What would you like to do in Holt? What would Holt school officials like to do? Would they like a year of tuition?
We're modeling it on the Kalamazoo and Lansing promise, where you're looking at a couple years to LCC for all graduates. It will start on the upper and lower end, so we'll try to reward people that excel in school and those that might have financial challenges, and then bring that gap together, hopefully, to get everybody. But that's the goal. And right now, we're just, as we said, starting planting the seeds.
Is there a lot of support for the Mason Promise? I mean, has this really become a part of the Mason community that's a really, really a priority for the community in general?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's doing very well. And this is something, when CJ approached me with this, like I said, it started off as a battle of bands between him and me, and then just kind of blossomed. And we're getting the Mason Scholarship people involved, and hopefully it'll become an annual fundraiser for them, something that they can continue on for years and contribute to their thing. But no, they have a good solid base and do very well with their fundraising.
Has this been kicked around in Holt for a while then, CJ?
Stuart Goodrich started the scholarship program, I believe, the last year that he was in. So we're just heading into our second year. So the funds, we'd need funding sources. And so it seemed to me this was a natural way to get it going and to advertise the scholarship fund and get it out all the way so that people know it's there, so that they can start including it on their giving calendar.
And Holt and Mason, H-A-M, we're calling these the Hammies. Is that correct?
Sheriff Gene Rigglesworth is going to be the blame for that. We are thinking up names and we tossed it off. And that man has a mind that's crazy. He came up with about 6 different names in about 30 seconds. Do not play word jumble with Sheriff Rigglesworth.
You do enough.
Just telling you.
You do all that serious police work. You got to have an outlet.
He's got his mind. We were just all sitting there staring at him because he just kept going. And we're like, really? Because anyway, it was great.
Tonight at Holt High School, the first annual Holt and Mason Scholarship Challenge. We've been, be there, be generous with your the money you put into this. Delhi Township Supervisor CJ Davis and Mason Mayor Leon Clark. Good luck with all of this.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State on Wednesday, a proposal by State Senator Tom Casperson to deprioritize biodiversity in the state has triggered some sharp responses from environmentalists. We'll talk with Senator Casperson and with Ann Y. Woody of the Sierra Club of Michigan. And our weekly Neighbors in Action segment looks at the important community work being done by the Lansing JCs, and we'll learn about the newest addition to the Mid-Michigan ice cream landscape as well. You've been listening to Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Aaron Young, many thanks for your fine work on engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.